This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about feeling different with Elise. She's our youngest ever guest and came on the podcast to talk about how growing up with a tumour that required a lot of repeated surgery made her feel outside of her peer group and really led to or exacerbated mental health problems she experienced. First off, we've got a definition for what it is to be an outsider from the Cambridge English Dictionary, which is a person who is not liked or accepted as a member of a particular group, organisation, or society, and who feels different from those people who are accepted as members. I quite like that. I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it does sum it up. It's subjective. It's so subjective, isn't it? What an outsider feels like, what you should feel like. It's only you that feels like that. But there's a thin line between that and maybe bullying, like being made to feel, you know, by a group of people not including you. Mm-hmm. But from our experiences of physical illness, mental illness, how that can affect you and absolutely make you feel because of that, that you're then an outsider, even if the world isn't seeing you that way.
Right, absolutely. That definition is quite cold. It doesn't acknowledge how it feels to be an outsider. Yeah. It just kind of defines what that is.
Yeah, and I think that's just so subjective.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. And Elise is, I think, an ideal guest to explore this because she's got that on a few levels. She had physical and mental health difficulties that made certain things like school life more difficult than it would be for most people.
Mm.
And there's that kind of layering effect where you're dealing with a few different things. And as a young person, you really just want to fit in. Yeah. I know I did. And from a young age, I had to kind of come to terms with that I wasn't a person that fits in.
Oh, yeah. And that's the whole point. I guess it's more feeling different than being an outsider, because I think that term outsider is a tricky one to kind of talk about. Right. Feeling different is different to that. And you're right, when you're young, kind of all you want to do is be like everybody else. But that's the whole thing, like that you've just said. The only way to be different, actually, is by being yourself, but how important it is to accept your differences, you know.
Mm.
Even yesterday, my little girl did not want to go to netball because her hair was a mess. You know, she's five. And I'm like, obviously not into like overly like hair and what you look like and what other people think. But she was so adamant that I'd just change her hair bubble because everybody would be looking at her.
Wow.
And I think, again, as society, we've got to really support our young people and children, you know, to embrace being different and see it even as a privilege. I say to my kids, who wants to be the same?
Right, for sure, because that does start so young, like with your kids. And for Elise, she's 18 years old and she's already had so many years of these feelings that I was really glad to get someone on who can really give that perspective of what it was like being in school and with that being so recent for her.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm delighted with the interview, and we've got some stats as always as well. So first off, from the World Health Survey of 2007, evidence demonstrates those with long-term conditions are two or three times more likely to develop mental ill health. Also, people with two or more long-term health conditions are seven times more likely to experience depression than those without a long-term condition. So here we're referring to conditions that can include the tumour that she experienced.
Wow.
And that's just a really clear example of how much living with long-term physical health difficulties can affect your mental health. It's so intrinsically linked.
So intrinsically linked.
And depression, like mentioned there, is something that Elise has experienced.
And now look at her. She has just had such a hard time, but it's come out of it. You know, she's absolutely beautiful. She looks physically different. And I just looked at her and felt so like, I don't even know her, but I just felt so proud of her for just embracing her beauty and campaigning and trying to help other people who are at school or older people, you know, who go through this feeling of feeling different and how, you know, how detrimental it can be, she'll think I'd never change it. Because what I've learned and the person that I am and who I've helped and my whole journey is because of what I went through when I was young. And actually, looking back, I'd never change it. So in that moment, it might feel hard. But you know what? When you do something so positive with it like she is, it's amazing. It's life-changing, you know?
Right. And we talk so much about the kind of invisible nature of mental illness. She's an example of someone who has physical scars from the surgery she's been through. So I'm really glad we also touched on how that kind of very visual difference can affect you, how to a certain extent you're forced to wear some of the things you've been through in a way that with mental illness there can be this pressure to hide it. It's like two ends of the same spectrum there. It does remind me of a previous episode we did with Sylvia Mack, episode 68.
Yeah.
Where she had burns from her childhood. And how that part of her experience, that trauma that she'd been through, is something you can see when you meet her. And she's sort of forced to have that story, but in learning to own it and find power from it and do work to make other people feel less different, that's where she's really found power over it. And I think Elise has been quite similar, as you'll hear in the interview. She's really found ways to own a lot of the things she's been through and now works as an advocate to help people feel the opposite, feel more of a part of a community and that they will get through these things and there is a space for them.
Absolutely. She's got such a mature head on her shoulders, hasn't she? She was like looking after the world, like, you know, she knows what she's about. And again, that comes from her experiences, being forced to deal with some probably pretty dark times.
Yeah, it can really change things for you. Mm. You know, it can make you grow up faster. But whilst we can't change that, what you do with it, I think, is so key. Yeah. You know, if you can own that and find the skills through it, you know, that's what I've tried to do with this podcast, find the skills and the empathy I've learned through experiencing mental illness and do something with it.
Yeah.
Make a positive change. And the last thing I wanted to mention on prevalence from the Mental Health Foundation, again, in terms of long-term conditions, more than 15 million people, 30% of the UK population, live with one or more long-term condition, according to the Department of Health. And more than 4 million also have a mental health problem. So that gives you an idea how many people are living with long-term illnesses, not just mental, which can so often require the same kind of day-to-day work. You know, if you speak to somebody with diabetes or that's on medication for long-term physical ailments, there's so much work that goes into staying healthy.
Absolutely. And even me, you know, having played all sport all my life and now feeling like every time I have a game or go for a run, I'm like, my body's falling apart. I get all dramatic with it. Like I'm limping upstairs. But it's had a massive effect on the way I feel when I wake up in the morning. I can't go and have a run. My ankle was that sore this morning. And when you're already, perhaps, you know, even people who are already dealing with, you know, their own mental health problems, and maybe not always, even for me this week, it's not been a great week. And so that on top of it, physical things that you can't help add just extra weight to, oh God, and now this, and I can't deal with this, and it's making me sad, and I want to just curl up. It's hard. You know, I'm really pleased that we've approached this subject, because we talk a lot, obviously, about mental illness on the podcast, but the effects of on our mental health from a physical illness isn't always spoken about, you know. So I'm really pleased that we've touched on it and had such an amazing guest to educate us a bit more about it, actually.
For sure. So before we get into the interview with Elise, there's two more things we wanted to mention. First off, it is voting day here in the UK.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we try not to be too political here on mental, but what we will say is we've really hoped that you've voted, or that if you haven't yet, you're going to later today. It's so important. We talk a lot about on the podcast the effects of austerity, the effects of resources in terms of mental health support. And so whatever your political affiliation, I think it's so important to vote with that in mind. And also the On a more light-hearted note, it is forecast to be rainy on election day, and that has been shown in the past to make a difference to levels of turnout and levels of voting.
I can't believe that. Yeah, you just said that.
No, it's true. Well, by all means, listeners, Google yourselves, but both here and in the US, there's been quite a few studies into how rain can affect the kind of the swing, like left-wing, right-wing swing of a voting day. And there's a lot of theories I won't get into on why that is. So yeah, we hope that you voted. Danielle and I both have.
Yeah.
And the last thing to mention in the intro is our first ever live podcast recording in February.
Yay!
We introduced it briefly at the end of Hope's episode recently, but we have now finalised our lineup for that. And Hope is the first guest. So the theme for that recording will be mental health recovery. And so we've got a few guests that will be giving different perspectives, discussing different mental illnesses they've had experience of. So Hope will be there as one of them. Hopefully you've caught her recent episode, which was themed around abuse, but she'll be mainly talking about her experience of an eating disorder and recovery around that. We've also got Charles Edison, who you'll remember as one of our first ever recordings where we did an episode on addiction. He's a rapper and producer based in London who will also be doing the music that rounds up the night show. And finally, Byron Langley, who is new to the podcast. He is mainly known for YouTube fame and collaborates a lot with his roommates Casper Lee and Joe Sugg. So I'm really looking forward to hearing how that type of internet fame has affected his recovery, being so open about his life with his following, how that may make it more difficult.
I know, how interesting. It'd be really good to get all three of them together. That's what I'm really looking forward to. That's what's, you know, we're excited about, isn't it, with our live show, that it's the first time that we're going to be able to have three different perspectives and you know, really discussing different topics. Mm-hmm. And our first three guests are amazing, so it's
absolutely
going to be good.
It'll be interesting, that more discussion format. And of course, if you can make it along to the live show, you'll get not only to see the recording happen live, see the bits that don't get cropped, the full-length interview. We'll also have a Q&A section where you can write down questions in the break and we'll answer them afterwards. There'll be a meet and greet if you want to come and chat to any of us. And like I mentioned, there'll be live music from Charles as well. It should be a really fascinating, fun afternoon. And that is at a venue in Shoreditch called Colours Hoxton. If you want to get tickets, you can find them on mentalpodcast.co.uk/live. That will also be linked in the episode description. You do get a discount for booking in advance, so I'd really encourage you to. We should be selling that out. So yeah, very exciting. Hope to see as many of you there as possible. And if there's any further updates, we'll make sure to mention them.
Yeah, and January is always, you know, quiet for people, isn't it, after Christmas? So everyone get out, you know, look forward to it. Get in your diaries, February. I'm really looking forward to it. It's that, you know, obviously it's my birthday before then. But that first week of February is always a nice, busy, great vibe out on the streets. Everyone wants to go out and enjoy themselves after a bit of a January lull. So we're really looking forward to seeing you all there. So hopefully you can all get a ticket and get down to Hoxton. Come and have some fun with us.
All right. And so we'll now get into the episode with Elise in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Elise and I'm from Speaking Up Today on Instagram.
So am I right in thinking that your first experience of mental illness started around the time you were diagnosed with an intravenous malformation?
Yeah, and that's basically in like simple terms where in a certain area, normally on the face, it's commonly found, normally in the brain, but I had mine in my nose and it's where there's an excess amount of blood flow, which then creates a pulse, which I'd always had a birthmark on my nose, so we didn't really think anything of it because I was always so used to having a birthmark and I've got them everywhere. So when my nose started to change, we just thought it was as I was getting older.
Right.
And they are there from birth, but some people, they grow much later on in life and some people, they develop when they were younger, and that's what happened to mine. But in the area that we was in, my doctors, the local GP, we saw quite like a few in my GP surgery, and a lot of them just fobbed us off and was like, it's nothing to worry about, it's normal, it'll go. And obviously my mum knew what was going on wasn't normal, because I actually had like a little pea-sized thing at the end of my nose.
Right.
And one day that had fallen off. And that's kind of when my mum went back to the local GP and said, this isn't normal, we want to be referred to the ear, nose and throat at locally in Hull.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and luckily the surgeon that I saw, he said, look, it's an AVM, this is what it is, and he explained the full thing. But of course, at 9 years old, you don't really understand a lot of
right.
what's going on. And to me, I would just always nod along, say yes, and then ask my mum what it meant later. And he did say to me right from the start, this is complex and we don't quite know if you'll make it through, like what we can do for you, because if we can't stop it, it will eventually bleed out. And then it was at that point I had quite a few nosebleeds, and that would become regular, and I'd wake up during the night and it became quite normal. It'd be like, mum, I'm having a nosebleed again, like, can you wake up, kind of thing. So then I had two surgeries in Hull, and my surgeon turned around and said, we can't stop it, we can't quite catch it here. And he said, however, I do know someone in Birmingham. And then he said, if it's not Birmingham, it will be America. So obviously we were just hoping that here in Birmingham that someone could do something, because obviously the thought of going to America was obviously a lot of stress to my mum. My mum was a single parent, so there was a lot of pressure on her. And then we came here.
And do you have any siblings?
No, I'm an only child, right. So it's always just been me. So I didn't really have that, like, someone my own age or around that to talk to. So everyone I was always surrounded by was adults. That's quite scary at a young age, because you've got all these adults talking about how important it is, what can happen. But I didn't really understand it at, like, 9 and 10 years old, what was going on.
Yeah, and from my understanding, it's quite a difficult condition in that way, in that biologically it's relatively simple. It's a malformation around how your blood vessels are forming, and for want of a better way of explaining it, it's kind of like they get tangled, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of, on the surface of it, seems relatively simple, but because it's uncommon and because the side effects can be so broad, there are so many possibilities of what could happen, and I imagine that would have been very scary.
Yeah, because when I was younger, I couldn't really Google it, because I didn't have a phone that you was able to do that at the time. I just had one of the old Nokia bricks. I was like, there's nothing I can really do to research it. And then when I had a look at Mum's phone and researched it, that's when I started to understand, like, all these side effects and what it actually meant. Because when I was at Hull, I was treated like a child, and everything was explained to me in very basic form, and a lot was hidden, until I came to Birmingham, where everything was explained a lot more and I was treated like an adult from the start.
Right.
Which was a lot better, because it's sometimes when you're a child, people can be quite like, this is what's going to happen, whereas my surgeon just put it straight out there, and he said from the off start, look, we'll try what we can, but there's not always a chance that you can cauterize it, and there's not always a chance you can stop it.
Right. And so in your case, the particular side effect they were really worried about was that it would just keep bleeding and one day they wouldn't be able to stop.
Yeah, and that, I think that's the thing that scared me, because as a child, I didn't understand a lot of the medical jargon, but what I could understand was that I was having all these nosebleeds. Like, I would wake up through the night, and Mum, like, will say now, we probably went through like 20 pillows in like 2 or 3 months sometimes, because of the amount it would bleed. And obviously that's when you start to understand how serious something is. But I was very lucky that, in a way, my mum had seen a programme with Katie Piper where a girl had had the exact same condition as me before, and I never saw that programme, but in a way that worried my mum, because she saw the worst case scenario and that certain points might fail and that your body can reject certain things, like with any surgery. So at first it was very much a lot of MRIs, like scans, all that kind of thing, just to see what they could do. And then I had a few operations at the start, and that wasn't really doing anything. And then they injected this thing called Onyx, was actually pioneered by my surgeon, and that was to stop the blood flow. And then that works, but the problem was, is in that time I'd have to wait 6 months. But when they was injecting this Onyx into my nose, it was making my nose a lot bigger, a lot swollen. And by this point, it didn't really look much like a nose anymore.
Right.
And I was fine at the well, I thought I was fine at the time. I just got through a lot of stuff. Nothing really bothered me. However, when I was going out with my mum, a lot of kids would stare because a lot of, even adults, a lot of people have questions when someone looks different. So I knew from a young age I didn't look the same as everyone else. And that didn't really bother me because when I was at primary school, you'd been with them for the last 6-7 years. And then when you move into high school, even then I wasn't as bothered because I went to an all-girls school. So I didn't have that worry of like the pressure of boys and all that kind of thing, which a lot of girls do at that age.
Yep.
So I was quite lucky in that sense. And then I was also lucky throughout my full operations. I was never bullied at school, which I always say is something I'm very lucky that I didn't have to go through because a lot of people do.
Yeah, but absolutely.
My biggest thing where I think my anxiety started is when they completely removed my nose because they realised they couldn't save what was already there, and in order to get rid of my avian, they had to remove my nose, is I wasn't at school for 3 months. I had to take 3 months off school completely, and I wasn't allowed to go in out in that time in public. It was literally my nana's house or my granddad's house, and that's all I ever used to see.
So just ask about that then. You weren't allowed to go out because of, like, not getting infection, or what was the reason?
Yeah, because of infection, because of the way I looked. In that particular surgery, I had my full hair shaved, like 3/4 of it, because part of the procedure was that they had to use part of the skin from my head, and that wouldn't have obviously been safe and hygienic to keep my hair. And I think that was one of the main points in my operations that I say now, as small as it may seem, is that's when I really started to like be affected by them, because everyone I knew had long hair. And I feel like at 13, that's quite an important thing as a girl.
Yeah.
It's like, vain as it might sound, is to have nice hair. And I feel like I'd gone backwards to completely cutting my hair, and I knew I would have to go back to school looking like this. I knew I was going to look completely different. And I think I saw my best friend, who saw me throughout my full operations and was never fazed by anything. If she sees a picture now, she sees it as quite normal. But I didn't want anyone from school seeing it, because I was so afraid of like rumours spreading around school, what I looked like. And even though my friends, you just never quite know. And I think when you spend a lot of time with adults, it's not quite people your own age. And I just really started to get anxious. And I feel like children often pick up on adults' emotions, and I started to do that with my mum. And she became quite nervous to come out with me, and so did my nana, because a lot of people used to come in. And I remember one specific time, it was just before my big surgery where they completely removed my nose, and a small child had gone to their parent like, what's wrong with that girl? Why does she look so weird? Why does she look so different? And my mum never used to retaliate to it, and this time she did. And I think for me, that's when I realised that everything was going to be different, and I started to realise that I wasn't going to be the same. Now, looking back, would I have said that I struggled with my mental health or a mental illness at that point? No. But as I've gone through counselling, and I look back, I used to write a lot of dark things at that time. I used to have a book where I'd write all my feelings down, and that had quite a lot of depressing stuff in it, where I'd write always in third person about something bad happening to something else. And at the time, that's not something I shared with anyone. And I was always offered help, but I think I didn't want it, because for me, I could get through it. I thought I was doing fine. And I was never bothered by surgery. Like, I've had over 15 operations, and not once was I bothered by them. When I went down to surgery, they'd always say, like, do you want the mask on to calm you down? And I'd say, no, I'm absolutely fine. And then my heart rate would always show that. And, like, the thing with my operations is I was very lucky that everything always went right, because I'd seen with the girl that was on the TV programme that it could have gone really wrong,
mm-hmm.
and that I could have had a lot more surgeries than I did. And there's a young girl I watch on YouTube, Nikki Lilly, and she's got my condition, and they don't know if they can ever stop hers. And that's when I kind of realised, especially as I got older, that even though what I went through was horrible, it could have been a lot worse. And I think the thing I always say to my mum is, at least I'm healthy now.
So it's interesting there, the way you've contrasted, like, looking back on it. So you didn't realise the mental health issues you were experiencing, and that you had the anxiety existing, but then it was being made so much worse by being away from the outside world, essentially. So all these things that for many kids would be normal, like going to school every day, you didn't have that experience, and so it became a massive thing in your head.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I've learned with my counsellor. And when I look back, is she will always say to me, what you went through was trauma. So not many people who go through trauma experience the feelings at the time. It's huge. She said it can be a year after, it can be 10 years after, and it, for some people, it can be a long 20 years after. And she said to me, there's times, especially now, that like I'll go to take a selfie or like something like that, or my mum wants to take a picture, and I won't want to, because there is still sometimes that thing in me that was like, no, I don't look like everyone else. I'll be like, mum, I'm not in the mood today. And that was something I found with my Instagram. I had my Instagram a good 4 months before putting my face out there, just because I could put what I wanted on my Instagram and be me. And I think sometimes I often felt it, I didn't want people feeling sorry for me, and I didn't want to draw attention to it. But when I did post a picture on Instagram, there was no comments about my nose, because I've realised as I've got older, most people, yeah, they'll question it or they'll look at it and it does look different, but a lot of adults generally don't care what you look like. And I found on my Instagram, like, when I've spoke to people I've gotten to know really well, they said it's not even the first thing I noticed about you. And I think I built it in my head as this really big thing, when in fact it doesn't actually affect me as much as I thought it would now. And don't get me wrong, I've worked on it a lot in counselling, but it's not the first thing I spoke about in counselling. For me, I started counselling in September 2018, and I didn't speak about it well into March, May of this year. Don't get me wrong, there are times where I still struggle with my operations, and I have had those moments where I think, why did I have to go through it? But I wouldn't change any of it now, and it hadn't have happened, or I wish that like I did look normal, because I've learnt that's just what makes me me, and I could have lost my life. And I think that's what really keeps me going a lot of the time, is it's gone now and it's literally got 1% chance of coming back. It's not likely.
For sure, absolutely. It must be such a weight off. But I can see your experience is one that's actually quite often the case when you have long-term treatment for physical conditions, that I think the NHS can be really good at dealing with the physical side of it, and then sometimes the mental health side of it can be a little bit neglected.
Yeah, and I think the difficult thing was, is I was 2.5 hours away from home, so any referrals to any mental health team wouldn't have always been local. And I feel like,
right,
even if it, they did say like, we can get you a local referral, but my argument was, there's always that cross of medical records and medical background. And I honestly just wasn't ready. There was a whole lot, especially from like 13 onwards, there was a whole lot more going on in my life that wasn't related to my operations. So I always felt like, I don't want to be referred for my operations when this isn't the main thing going on anymore.
And also, it sounds like you'd worked so hard at coming to terms with your AVM and coming to terms with the operations, that you sort of in your mind had a lot of that sorted. And I can tell that in the way you talk about it, that you were very self-assured and I think a hell of a lot less scared than I think I would have been from the age of 9. But then maybe the bit that was scary for you was the mental health side that you weren't focused on, that you maybe feel like you were purposely ignoring a little bit.
Looking back on that time, I definitely ignored the whole mental health side of it, because between the ages of 9 and 13 where I ignored it, it wasn't, mental health wasn't the conversation that it is now. And like, I certainly didn't go to school and someone would say, oh, I'm suffering with depression, or I've got anxiety, because there wasn't any of that. Even at family parties, even where I knew people probably had anxiety around the time my operation started anyways, because I was always so quiet. And if we were at a family party, I was always that person in the corner, and I just never wanted to draw attention to myself. So looking back, there was a whole lot of mental illness. I just wasn't ready to acknowledge it then. And I think at the time, I was still dealing quite well. I was still going to school. I was still performing at school. So it's not like my grades were dropping and it was noticeable. And that's one thing I've noticed, is a complete theme around my mental health. It's never noticeable, because for a large part of my mental health, I've been in school and I never have dropped my grades. They always stayed the same. So I feel like I did quite a good job at suppressing it and hide it from everyone else.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And often that is a part of the stigma, that we have these stereotypes of what mental illness looks like. And so if you weren't fitting that, if you were succeeding academically and you were fitting in despite your challenges, surely adults will just look on that and be like, she's doing great. She's very well adjusted. No issues there. And that's the kind of binary nature that people often get trapped with when it comes to mental health, that everyone's either well or they're ill. Yeah. And so if you didn't seem stereotypically mentally ill, then they're just like, she's absolutely fine then.
And that's what I found in my high school, as supportive as there was that whole thing of I was always quite ignored, because the one thing that, like, when you get the, like, in year 11 where teacher signed books and that kind of thing, the whole comment I'd always get is about how smiley I was.
Right.
And that's something that I will say to anybody, is a smile can hide a lot. And I think that's what happened with me in school, because some teachers knew about it. They had to, just because when I came back from my operation, I had my hair shaved. I had to wear something around my hair because I still had part of it, which obviously didn't fit in with school uniform. And even then, there was never that real ask from school of, how are you actually doing? Like, are you ready to come back? Because I was supported when I came back, but because I seemed fine in my classes afterwards, there was no follow-up. And I think when I was 13, one of my operations I had after my granddad died, and I think that's something that my school completely missed in terms of mental health, because I actually did start to digress a bit in school, but I was still smiley, I was still happy. So as far as everyone was concerned, nothing was going on. But there was one teacher in my school who started to notice at the end. I did drama at school, but it got changed to expressive performing arts. So I was allowed to write as part of my drama, which is an outlet that I still use now, and I find it good to get things out. And it was about identity, was the theme. Because of what I'd been through, it just completely came out in this book. And I think that's where I first started to open up and talking about it, because I couldn't really avoid the fact I just completely put my feelings down in this work. And my mum will even say, and my teacher said, looking back, it was a dark piece of work. And I actually did really well on that. I got an A star in my coursework because I actually wrote how I was feeling. But again, it was still ignored. School never really was like, do you want in-school counselling? Or like, do we need to tell your parents? It was just a bit like, she's just good at the subject, which I think is a big problem, because I know how much I was struggling at the time, and I know the type of things that I'd write and of those pieces of work. And there was times where it would go to the heads of departments to be monitored and checked, and that'd be it. There was never that question of, how is your mental health?
And sadly, that's not something I'm surprised by. And that's a big part of why I campaign for mental health education in schools, because the schools are ill-prepared to deal with mental illness, and the teachers know that. And so a lot of them feel it's safer to not even ask than it is to try and tackle anything. And whilst that's not an approach that achieves anything, I can understand why there can be such fear around it. There's this kind of opening a can of worms mentality that if you were to ask as a teacher when you'd gone through losing a relative how you were, well, then what if you really are struggling and they're not able to help you?
And that's exactly what I saw, because there was one, I never, apart from my operations, I had 100% attendance. I was always at school. I actually quite liked school. My granddad passed away over half term, which I was quite lucky because I had that time off over Easter to deal with it all. But my granddad was ill for a very long time. He was literally diagnosed with cancer 6 months after I was diagnosed with my AVM. So obviously that was quite a difficult time in the family.
For sure.
It was difficult for my mum because she was a single parent and she was trying to deal with me and the dad at the same time, which was difficult as a child, because I found in counselling that a lot of the time I felt I had to be strong for my mum, because even her ex-partner at the time wasn't the most supportive of the situation. So I learned from a very young age how to be supportive of an adult. And after my granddad passed away, mum was diagnosed with depression, and I learned at 13/14 how to look after a parent with depression. And I think it's then I realised that I was probably depressed as well. But the common theme between my age of 9 and 15 is I just ignored it because I didn't know who to turn to in high school because it was never advertised who to go to when you're struggling. I knew we had a school nurse, but again, I didn't want to go to her because I didn't want to get him back to my mum. And I know under 16, everything has to go back to your parents. So.
And that's it. I think we can get into this survival mode when people around us are in need. And so in comparison with what you were going through with your physical health, which was obvious and was a big part of your life, there was no getting away from that. There was no pushing that down when you needed to have all these operations, whereas your mental health was something that was easier to sort of put away and ignore.
Yeah, definitely. Like in year 11, I had a best friend and we'd had a big argument, but I was only in a school of 600. So everyone in the year group pretty much knew everyone and everyone knew about this friendship breakup.
Right.
It was literally the talk, and that's where my mental health literally went from me being able to deal with it to not coping at all, because school was always that place I felt safe. When things were difficult at home, for those 6 hours a day, I could just be me and not my past kind of thing or like what was going on at the time. And when this friendship breakup happened, that completely went in school, and there was arguments and the thing was with an all-girl school, people get involved because when there's an argument, everybody wants to know why. And that's when I quickly fell into my eating disorder, which again, I didn't talk about at the time. No one I knew had an eating disorder. It wasn't something that was talked about. It was something that I'd seen on films, or it was something that I'd seen on like the internet maybe. But again, there was that stereotype of you had to be a certain size to have an eating disorder. So it's something I kept very, very, very quiet. And I didn't tell my mum at all. And I think the problem with that is the more you quiet an eating disorder, the worse it gets, because it becomes that secret. And for me, that's exactly what it became, and I hid it. I completely hid it from school. And then as time was going on, I just felt depressed all the time. I felt anxious. School, it was coming up to my exams, and I'd work all day at school and I'd get back home and I'd work all day again. So I very quickly burnt myself out. But again, I didn't even know what a burnout was because no one was ever talking about it. And that's something that I always think, there's been stress for exams and then there's not been able to cope with them. And that was the difference that...
Yeah. And I think a lot of the problem is that in lieu of acknowledging these things, it's very one-way pressure. You're constantly being told stress is normal. These exams are really important. You should be nervous about them. No one is saying the opposite of there is such a thing as being too stressed and too anxious. And so it can be very easy as a young person to pretend nothing's going on or to not acknowledge these feelings.
Yeah, and that absolutely. And something that I found out when I went to college is I was dyslexic, and that was ignored throughout all of school. Now, I used to say all the time, "Mum, I'm dyslexic. I'm telling you I am." I honestly didn't really know what dyslexia was fully until I went for the test, because if anyone had asked me, I literally would have said, you struggle to read. And looking back, there was a lot of things that made sense about me being dyslexic. But again, school completely missed it, because as much as I couldn't spell and as much as there were some struggles with my writing, again, in English, I was getting a B. So it's overlooked.
And this is what I think so much of mental health support in schools comes back to, that it's not acceptable that the current baseline is the kids should be coping. The kids should be thriving. They shouldn't be empowered to know how to manage their own mental health, to know what to do if symptoms do come up. It's not enough for them to just be coping and getting by. And it sounds like that's what was happening with you. I had dyslexia when I was younger. I still struggle with it now. I was visibly not coping. I was being kept in and not being given like lunch and break times because I was so behind on my work. So there was a really obvious problem there, but it shouldn't be that you have to be that behind for people to start asking questions.
And that's exactly what I found like in school. I knew that I couldn't write quick enough in exams, and I knew that, I knew that when you did them in classrooms, I'd see people be on the next question, or like when we'd write notes in the class, I was literally like, I never stopped writing because I just couldn't keep up. And when I got to college, my English, I did A-level English, and he turned around to me and said, have you ever been tested for dyslexia? And that was in 1 week. And then I found out not only did I need 25% in my exams extra time, I actually needed a laptop because my writing speed was way below average for my age. And I think for me, not a lot of people understand with something like dyslexia, then it can affect your mental health. I'd got these GCSE grades, some of them were below my predicted, and I'd worked so hard. But for me, none of that hard work really benefited me because the one factor that I didn't clearly know was getting in my way was being dyslexic. And I think that's frustrating knowing you could have got a grade and you worked so hard and that you put your mental health on the line for a grade that I never got.
For sure. And also with the way education is structured, unless you get the support, you're being kind of set up to fail. Like my favourite subject at school was English. It was the grade I got the worst A-level in. But I'm very glad I did it. But then again, I had the support. I knew I had dyslexia. I knew I was going to get a bad grade. So I was happy to go along and just try and enjoy the subject. But you're being completely set up to fail if you don't have that information.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me. Now, I was very honest about my mental health, especially in the second year of college. I'd started counselling. I was open with all my teachers. Some of them I emailed, some of them I was able to speak to. And I said, look, I've got anxiety, I do have depression, and I am massively struggling with an eating disorder, and that's how it is. And I said, some days I'm going to come into your classroom and be really present. And I said, some days I'm going to come in and it's going to be like a complete new person, I'm going to be disengaged. And my English teacher knew all of this. She also knew I was dyslexic. I asked for help so many times, like extra help. I was willing to come in on a lunch. Like, I was willing to put that effort in. And I did health and social care, and I was always getting a distinction star in that. I did geography, and I was always getting a B or an A. But for English, I was always just scraping a C. And my English teacher on results day, I actually did get a C in my English. And when I was speaking to her what I wanted to do in the future, and I said, oh, I'm currently writing for a guest blog for this company. And then I said, but I'm struggling because of my spelling, and I don't want that to affect it. And she turned around, laughed, and was like, yeah, you can't spell, you're probably not going to get very far.
Wow. That's just failing basic what it is to be a teacher, let alone anything mental health-wise.
And I think that, especially with my Instagram, I'd spend hours before, when it came to my Instagram, literally making sure there was a comma here, there was that there, and it was just completely, like, taking away the, like, goodness out of my Instagram. Like, it became a chore because I was so worried about my spelling. And then it's my best friend turned around to me and she said, Elise, the brain reads what it needs to read anyway. She said, stop worrying about it. And I feel like that's an important thing that I always try and say to people, is if someone tells you no, or you struggle with your mental health, and even if it's yourself that's telling you not to do it, is to do it. Don't stop doing what you wanted to do because someone's told you. If I had listened to my English teacher, then I'd probably have quit my Instagram ages ago. I put myself down for so long and made myself feel so bad, yet it wasn't actually a problem. And the thing is with this teacher that I look back and I think I was at my worst of my eating disorder in college. So I'd literally, from 9 to 17, completely compressed all my feelings and thought, let's put them in a box, ignore them, and it'll all be fine. And I very quickly realised that I could use food to deal with A-level pressure.
Right.
And in my first year, it wasn't so bad because I was still eating. It wasn't that much of a struggle. But as time went on, I found a lot of the darker side of the internet where I was very much influenced by it. And I used to write in a book at college when I was feeling down. And one of my friends one day, I'd gone to get a drink and she'd found it. And this literally contained me writing what I ate. It contained me writing how I feel. And she took it to the safeguarding officer at our college. And I was so supported by my college. That's one thing I'm so grateful for. My tutor was amazing. There were some days where I'd literally knock on her door 3 times a day because I'd have a panic attack. And she would sit with me until that's over. But I just remember being so annoyed at this friend that she'd kind of taken away my secret. That was the most difficult thing for me because I hadn't even got a chance to tell my mum. And school knew, and again, they've got to tell your parents. I was so scared of what was going to come out because I kept things quiet at home. The thing that it did teach me, though, is that I knew I wanted counselling because for a very, very long time, I don't need to speak to anyone and I'm fine. And that's what I found with a lot of people, is it doesn't matter if you're struggling 4 days out of the week or 2 days out of the week. The fact is, you're still struggling. And that's not a normal thing to be happening on that level.
And it sounds like that's the kind of thing it would have taken you a long time to maybe figure out on your own. That you'd got so used to owning your own narrative and deciding what you would and wouldn't let other people see.
Yeah. And the thing is with school is, literally, I remember the safeguarding officer saying to me, "You've lost a lot of weight, we've noticed it," but obviously we didn't want to approach it and say anything because we didn't want to be in the wrong type of thing. And I think that goes back to what you said, is schools don't quite know when to like contact a student. There was a good few months that year where I just couldn't see the next month, and I couldn't see the month after that. And I knew eventually I'd wanted to finish my levels, but I just couldn't see it.
And so when you say that, were you struggling to see a future for yourself, or were you just only coping kind of day by day?
I think both. Like, in a way, I was coping just day by day. I thought just a lot of the time it was just get to the weekend. But then the weekend had come and I think, now what do? Because it's Monday's coming again. And it was that cycle of, I didn't know if I wanted help. I wanted help, but some days I didn't, type of thing.
And it sounds like within that, so much was just going unsaid, that there was this weighted silence on you because the school, I can imagine, had this common feeling of, well, we can't get involved because we may not have all the answers.
Yeah.
And we don't want to get things wrong and we don't want to upset her. So they're feeling inferior and they don't know what to say. And then you are still, you know, in the very early stages of figuring out what's going on with your mental health. So then, of course, you don't know what to say, and so nobody's talking.
Yeah, and it was like, it was at a time where you had to start applying for uni.
Right.
And I just knew that there was no way I could have gone to uni the next year. I said to my mum, I always wanted to go to uni, not because I wanted to, because I felt like it was an expectation that you leave college and then you go into uni, and if you don't, it was kind of, especially at my school, as much as I loved college, it was very academic and it was very, we can send you on to the next steps. And one thing my college prided themselves in is being in the top 10% in the country. But along with that came a lot of academic pressures. And I remember my tutor saying to me, like, you need to start doing your uni application, all this kind of thing. And I said, I don't know how I can write a personal statement when I've got nothing positive to say about myself. And I think that's where it was kind of obvious that was, I was struggling, because my grades at this time had literally gone from an A in geography to a D.
But even within what you just said there is a great example of how the school wasn't supporting you, that you said, I couldn't think of anything positive to say about myself, and then you straight away gave grades as a reason, that the school had done such a successful job of teaching you your worth is to do with your grades, that you didn't see that all you'd overcome outside of that.
Yeah, definitely, because we have this, well, we used to have this thing at our college where the end of year exams would dictate whether you got into that next year.
Right.
And if you didn't get a D, you wasn't. When it came to these big exams that we were made to do, I said, I can't go in that hall with all those people. There must have been literally 700 people in that hall because everyone was doing their exams.
Wow.
Which,
I mean, that's daunting for anyone, even without anxiety.
Which is a lot. Like, I'd gone from a school of 600 to a college of 2,000, which, considering there's only 2 year groups, is a hell of a lot. But all my college focused on is, you've got no doctor's letter, you've got none of that evidence. And then they said, right, because you're dyslexic, you need a laptop anyway, so we'll put you in a smaller room. And then I said, I can't be in a room full of people typing. That's just going to make me more anxious.
And so you would have just felt that self-conscious about the typing noises?
Yeah, and I wouldn't have wanted to type, because I'd be so scared of bothering everyone else, kind of thing. And even though I literally sat there and was like, I'm not mentally in the place to do this, all that was important to my college was that I did these end of year exams. And the sad thing is my tutor knew what a bad place I was in, and the safeguarding officer knew what a bad place I was in, like, quite in detail. Yet the senior team was like, she's still going to do these exams. And the problem was, I did the exams and I got a D, which was a pass. So again, it was a bit like, she did it though, didn't she? And that's when my safeguarding officer said, we can't do this anymore. He said, I'm ringing the doctors for an appointment. Like, you're going to go. And I think I knew that the time was right. And I remember sitting in the office with the safeguarding officer, and he rang the doctors and they said, we haven't got an appointment for 2 weeks. And he said, term ends in 2 weeks. We need an appointment. And then they was like, sorry, there's not a doctor available. And he was like, I don't care what she sees. And it was the moment when he went, she's lost so much weight in the last couple of weeks. Please, like, we don't care who sees her. And within that, there was like, we've got an appointment for tomorrow. But I didn't know who I was going to go with.
And I imagine that must have been quite scary for you to hear that phone call and hear how concerned staff were.
I think sometimes when you struggle with a mental illness, you don't ever realise how bad it is. And I only realised when I was out of it or I was in a better place with it. I remember going to that doctor's and my best friend at the time came with me. And like any appointment when it comes to like diagnosing depression, that kind of thing, she'd done the test that they do. And I remember answering the questions at the time and thinking about the responses and thinking, God, like, I've hid this for so long. I've completely ignored how depressed I am. And I remember going, oh, yeah, your depression and anxiety score is 24 out of 25.
Wow. And that's very uncommon.
And that's when I sat back and was like to myself, are you still going to lie? And obviously with that, she obviously asked me if there was anything else going on. And I said about my eating. Now, that was something I was really, really, really nervous to do, because when it comes to eating disorders, if your weight isn't a certain weight, in my experience, you're left to get worse. And then when you're at your worst point, then help comes in.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that, actually, because someone we've had on the podcast recently, Hope Virgo, campaigns against that, that there shouldn't be any weight requirement for eating disorder support. Not only is that unethical and can lead people to lose more weight on purpose, but also there are eating disorders which actually your weight will go the opposite direction.
Yeah, and that's something that I found twice when I went to doctors. Like, I wasn't underweight when I first got diagnosed with anorexia. She did say, your weight's not low enough, but the rest of your symptoms. And I was just lucky that I had a good GP. And then because of my referral and because of how bad my depression was and the scores and everything that came back, is Cam's rang my mum 2 hours later. I'd literally only just got picked up from my mum from college when this happened, so I didn't even have a chance to tell her yet. And I remember being on the phone at the time and I could hear it, and they literally went, your daughter's suffering with anorexia and bulimia. And how do you explain to your mum that some random on the phone has told them something you've not even had a chance to tell her yet? And that was difficult, because my mum always said to me she could understand why I wasn't eating, because that is and always has been my way of dealing with stress of any kind. Even now, I recently lost my great-grandma, and the first thing I default back to is, I'm feeling down, I'm just not going to eat. But at the time, I just thought that was a normal thing to do kind of thing. I don't think I actually understood what it was.
And also that can be quite tricky, because loss of appetite is often a symptom of grief anyway. So yeah, there's that kind of blurred line.
And then I think it's when I knew I was making myself sick and I knew I was bulimic. And I think that was the one thing I couldn't lie to myself with, because unlike weight loss, there's many things you can try and blame it on or try and say it is. Whereas when it comes to being bulimic, it's the one thing I kind of knew about. And I was so afraid to tell my mum. I was quite ashamed of my eating disorder. And I said to mum, yeah, that's not recent. And at the time, I was self-harming quite badly as well. And again, I just said to my mum, no, it's not recent. But the one thing the trap I'd got into is we were going to Dubai 3 weeks later. And I remember myself having like 2 weeks before, and I thought, how am I going to explain this to my mum? Because the one thing I did for all my mental health is lie. Because I never wanted to be bad. And I never wanted to not be seen as coping. Now I understand.
Right. And that's what happens if mental health is not acknowledged, if mental illness is not talked about existing. Then it's easy to grow up thinking, this isn't acceptable. There must be something wrong with me, because we're not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, like even with my mum, the only time she got help is when her dad passed away. And that was because it was grief. Like, that was understandable because she just lost someone and she was offered counselling. But when it came to me and everything else that was going on, there was nothing offered to her. So I kind of thought, well, my mum's just being left to deal with it. That's kind of how you go about it. Until 2018 September, where I'd waited 3 months to Cam's to get back to me, and it just wasn't happening, because especially in my area, it's a very stretched service, like most Cam's and most mental health services are. And I just thought, how long do you go on for like this? Literally in that summer was left to just get completely worse. And then My mum had rang up a private service near us, like, and their town done went, no, she's too complicated for us. But then you kind of think,
oh, wow,
what do you do in that sense? Because you're willing to pay private and someone's still telling you no. But this time they're telling you no because you're too complicated. Like, and my very words was to my mum, if I'm too complicated for them, how am I meant to understand me?
Exactly. And the truth of that situation is you may have been too complex for them. If they don't include the second half of that sentence, then it's just all back on you, that there must be another thing wrong with you. You're too much of a challenge, not you're outside of our competency level.
And I think I understand now, I did have quite a fair few different diagnoses. So my mum said in the September I was going back to college, and I thought, how the hell am I going to get through another year? And we'd heard nothing, and we'd spoke to camps, and they said, yeah, it's probably going to be a while.
And also the concern is you were getting closer and closer to turning 18, where, yeah, I'm assuming you would have then been passed to adult services and then potentially be at the start of the waiting list again.
Yeah, because I'd seen that with my friend, and that's when mum said, look, we'll go private. And something to say a lot of people is, I'm lucky I could afford to pay private, because that's not an option for so many people.
For sure.
And my counsellor now, I've been with her since last September, so just over 14 months. And for, I'd say, about 9 of those months, I went every single week for 9 months. I always thought, there's nothing wrong with me, it's not that bad. And that's where I realised that it was. And I think even when I was with my counsellor, I was very open about my operations and stuff that was going on. But the one thing I wasn't open about was my eating disorder, because I just didn't understand it until it got to December and I was going away. So like 2018, 2019. And I think for the first time, I'd gone to doctors. And the funny thing that it said to me is, while you're underweight, you're still not low enough. And it was the fact to me that it said to me, you're not low enough. So that kind of made me think, well, what is? And that's why I actually found Hope Virgo then, because Mum was seeing a counsellor, and Mum's counsellor said to her, recommend Hope. And I think that's then I realised that I wasn't alone, that I'd found a lot of people like me from her. And it started to make me realise, like, you shouldn't have to reach a certain point with anything for people to start listening. And one thing that I always make sure to say to people is, keep talking, because someone will listen. Because by the time I'd got to my counsellor, I'd waited for CAMHS. The private one had told me, hospital had told me, I was just too complicated. And I always say to my mum, if I'd have given up at any of those points, I don't know whether I'd reach my counsellor now.
Yeah, that's so important. And that's something that is rarely acknowledged, that it's like any other kind of relationship. Not every counsellor will work for you.
Yeah.
It's not a one-size-fits-all model. In the same way, you might reach a point with your current counsellor where you've sort of done what you can with them, and then you may need someone with a different kind of approach or different specialty, and that's completely okay too.
Yeah, and I am lucky that my counsellor was so fitting to me. But I worked on my anxiety for so long in counselling. I actually left college, able to completely put my hand up, get up in a classroom and do things I never thought I'd be able to.
You found one that's been that example to you and shown you there is a way to get past this. And that is something that's so often neglected in the NHS. I love the NHS, but there are a lot of times when doctors are scared to say, you're going to get through this. Because what, yeah, if they say that and you don't? But sometimes hope is a solid chunk of what people need.
And I think when people come to me on Instagram, and the one thing I always do make clear is, I will say, I'm not a professional. I've just been through it. I know what it's like. And I'll get people like to me saying, how do you do it? How have you become so positive? Like, what do I do? How do I do what you've done? And I always say to them, look, it takes work. I said, I'm never going to sit here and say that my counselling was a quick thing, that it was a problem solved quickly, because it never was. But the one thing that I knew is, a lot of it came from me.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people don't give themselves credit for, is I will say, oh my God, my counsellor's amazing, which she is. But then it's my counsellor, my mum will say, but you're the one that's done all the hard work. And that's what I'll say to people when they come to me and say, like, I've got no hope of this getting better. And I'll say to them, as cliche as it sounds, just hold on.
Yeah.
Because at any point from being 9, if I'd give up hope, I'd never got to this point. I'll always say, like, my physical illness was a lot easier than any of my mental illnesses were, because I feel like when you've got a physical illness, there's an explanation. It's obvious. You can say, you could go into work, and I could, or school if I wanted to, and say, I'm not feeling well today because of my AVM, and that would have been completely acceptable. And I know if it came to my exams in college and I'd have been suffering with my AVM at that time, I know if I'd said, I need to be in room because of my AVM, no one would have even thought twice about it. Whereas because it was a mental illness, there was a bit like, well, we can't see it, so it's not happening.
Yeah. Even with what you mentioned about people reaching out on Instagram and asking you how you got through it, it's part of the same thing, that because it's not visible, we can't always see what people are struggling with in their mind. There's not that easy fix. The honest answer is you work at it every day and it gets easier and you get better at coping with it. But people want that quick, like, fix.
Yeah, like, and that's what I found with an old friend, is that they kind of wanted that quick fix and didn't want to feel like that anymore, whereas I knew this was something that I was going to work on. Like, when we lost my great-grandma 2 weeks ago, I knew that was going to bring up a lot of old feelings for me, because I actually saw both of my grandparents, both of my granddads passed away. I was there when it happened, and I knew that was something that was going to come back these last 2 weeks. But the difference is because I've been in counselling, I knew how to deal with it.
But also you're, by the sounds of it, really accepting those times, that there are times when you're too anxious for certain tasks and you just make allowances for yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
And so many people really struggle with that, to almost forgive themselves for struggling, as if it's something they need forgiveness for at all.
And I think I found that with my mum, is with her depression, she now doesn't like sleeping in too long, because it instantly reminds her of a depression. And if she has bad days, she'll be like, oh, I need to get out of it. Like, I need to go do something. And I said to my mum, the best thing you can sometimes do is just let yourself feel. Because with mental illnesses, you often stop yourself from feeling, because you don't, especially with depression, like, sometimes for me, I didn't feel anything. And the one thing I'll say, especially these last 2 weeks with my grandma passing away, is I thought, I can either try and ignore this and do what I always do, and stop eating to deal with it, and completely ignore it, and burn myself out, or I can actually acknowledge it.
And that's a really lovely place to finish up on, then, the importance of feeling the feelings. If people want to find you online, where should they go?
Mainly my Instagram, which is Speaking Up Today, and there's always a link there to my blog, where I kind of just expand on my Instagram post. And I have a guest blog on my blog, which is other people's stories, what they've been through, because I'm very conscious of, I've not struggled with every mental illness there is out there, like, that I allow other people to speak about their illnesses with.
That's really great. Well, I love what you do, and you're really such an inspiration to me personally, so I'm so glad to get to speak to you today.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.